Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Well, here we are, Larry, recording live from FYP Studios, East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 258 of Registry Matters. I almost literally forgot what the name of the podcast was and what we were doing here. What are we doing here?
Well, we're actually doing episode 259, but who's counting?
Oh my God. See, so there's that other little, so for some reason, somebody made this little thing. Okay. So it's episode 259 for those of you keeping track at home. And so how are you doing this evening?
We're doing awesome. How are you?
I'm fan-freaking-tastic. As somebody who shall remain nameless is finer than frog hair, you probably know who I'm referring to.
I think I do. So,
Do me a favor, fine sir. Oh, what? Go ahead.
I understand you've had some respite over the last week.
I've been kind of on the road moving about. I was testing out if I could be a digital nomad for a handful of days. Going to see friends, family, and so forth around, gallivanting across the globe.
Well, I did receive a notification about a hovercraft, and I was very concerned. Did you spot that hovercraft?
I never saw anything related to a hovercraft, but that's because I was never in any one place for more than about 24 hours.
Oh, I see. All right.
So they probably had notice to send one out for a search, but they never had any opportunity to do anything and hone in and really isolate my position. I kept them on the run.
I see.
Well, tell me what we're doing tonight so that the show notes person can have all the information they need.
Well, we're going to be doing a review of a case that was just decided, I think, Thursday. We just got the paperwork on it today. It was decided Thursday or Friday out of Rhode Island, a federal case. It's been pending for several years. And then we're going to be doing some legislative wrap-up from my state and some general legislative discussions. And if time permits, an article or two, and maybe even a live question from our vast studio audience.
Fantastic. So if you do have a question and you're sitting there in the studio audience and you would like to ask a question, feel free to, towards the end of the show, collect your thoughts and maybe I can unmute you and you can ask a question. That's how that would go, right?
That's right. But make sure you don't have any jackhammers, weed eaters, or anything like that running when you're asking your question.
So legit, when we're doing another conference call kind of thing, one of the guests, one person had their cell phone sitting right next to their speakerphone that they were using, and the cell phone was like all night. And then another guest, it did sound like there was construction going on in their kitchen. It was really, really out of whack.
I think that was from Louisiana, if I remember right.
I believe so. Baton Rouge. Okay. Well, I guess we can dive right into this first question. This one was posted, if I'm not mistaken, I put down it's rm.co. So this one, I believe, was someone posted a comment on the website, on the Registry Matters website, and says, so, in Wisconsin, I pay $240 a month for GPS monitoring. So in the last 4.5 years, I have been charged $13,000 in services. If found unconstitutional, would I be able to get all of my money back due to the unconstitutionality of the law? I'm pretty sure no, but this is killing me financially.
Well, I appreciate that he knows the answer is likely not. I wouldn't say it's an absolute not, but it's very unlikely because the state is going to fight even more on that issue. Since it was presumed constitutional upon enactment, there's a level of immunity that goes with that presumption, and even if it turns out that they were wrong. So the first question I would have to look at would be, was it pled in the complaint, or the asking for damages, and what was the state's response to that? But normally, in a constitutional claim, you're only seeking a remedy of the declaration of unconstitutionality. So I would find it most unlikely that any money would be returned. But do the math there, 240 times 12 doesn't seem like it'd be $13,000 for 4 years. I'm not a great mathematician, but it seems a little high.
Well, I will run my snazzy calculator. I could ask the A word thing really quick, but I don't know if that would work out. So 240 times 12 times 4.5 It's 12,960.
I guess I'm just not very good at math. That's why. That's why I'm not.
Yeah. So, wow. That's there. I've referenced this a bajillion times. There's a podcast called Freakonomics, and like in June of 2015, there's an episode that they have something about why do we make sex offenders pay and pay and pay and pay and pay and pay and pay. And in there, they said that through treatment, through monitoring, and et cetera, that we are going to have PFRs come out of pocket for something of $10,000. And so here you go with more than. And in that podcast, which has like 3 million downloads a week, they said there's no reason, there's no benefit to all this thing, all these things that we make them go through for maybe a very small number of them. That, you know, like SVP kinds of people that would be diagnosed with an actual disease and so forth. But otherwise, it's just putting the screws to you is what they ultimately were saying.
It absolutely is. It's a tragedy. And I don't see how these people make it. First of all, the employment opportunities are certainly diminished in terms of earning potential. And then you have these huge amount of obligations related to GPS, related to polygraph examinations. Treatment cost, even if you're not being polygraphed. And the southern states are really big on restitution and fines. So you've got all these things that are following you. And I don't even know how they make it. So you're earning $17 an hour, theoretically. I mean, I know that's not minimum wage, but you manage to get a mediocre job that's paying you $15, $16, $17 an hour. How would you do it? How would you pay $1,000, $1,500 a month rent and then all these things?
I don't know. And I'm sure I've referenced a friend of mine that was in Augusta. When he had gotten out, he was in treatment and his treatment provider wanted him to take a poly. And it was right around Christmas and he just bought some Christmas gifts for his kids. And the treatment provider says, well, if you don't go take it, I'm going to, you know, put you as non-compliant in the class and you'll be thrown out, which will be considered a probation violation, which will send you back to jail. And he's like, what? Talks to his PO. PO says, I can push it off for like a month. So the guy goes and title pawns his car so that he can get the $200 or $300 off of that and pay for the poly. But then he has to work his ass off making minimum wage. And he's a couple years older than me. He's in, you know, at the time he was in his late 40s and he's working at a place where they're making steel sheds. So he's doing manual labor as a upper 40-year-old walking around a factory hauling metal tubes and crap. It's like, I just can't see how that's beneficial at all. I don't see on any level how that says, oh, well, you've really shown that you are treatable and that you're not going to recidivate and all that. I was like, this is just complete garbage.
Well, this is the land of forgiveness, remember?
I've heard this. Send us your tired and something like that, whatever, right?
Well, I'm speaking more from this spiritual and scriptural, you know, the being that's biblical. I think that if you look at how the people are treated in the Bible Belt, as we'll call it, they're treated worse there than anywhere else. So I'm not so sure that folks who run the Bible Belt are as forgiving as they would like us to believe.
I hear you. Oh, hey, let me ask you this quick question. Can we fall off the script for just a minute?
Sure. What you got in mind?
I have seen people posting some questions about something that it didn't even really register to me very much, but then I was thinking about it a little bit that I've heard of another state, but then I guess Arizona, but they're trying to make how do you delicately put this, but a facsimile of a human being used for entertainment purposes. Does that describe it well enough?
Are you talking about using a doll to replicate sexual activity is going to be illegal? Is that what you're talking about?
Pretty much. And so my question to you is, all things legislative and all that, how is that any different than any other type of toy that any adult would buy? What is the difference?
At first blush, I don't see any difference in it. But the question is, how are the opponents dealing and addressing this with their talking points and how they're responding to it legislatively, that those who are not in favor of it? And from what I was seeing on that thread that you're referring to, the response is really not ideal in terms of trying to win the battle.
So is their approach to bring evidence and things like that? Is that their approach?
That's what it was, what I was reading into it. They wanted to bring in statistics and data, and that's of no use in this argument. If you
tell me why, and what would you do instead?
Well, what I would do instead is I would be very graphic, as professionally as you can be graphic. And Arizona is still, although they have a currently Democratic governor, they have a slim majority in both the House and Senate with Republicans. And I think this is a Republican-sponsored piece of legislation. You make the argument to the Republicans that you have always stood for keeping government out of people's bedrooms. Now, we know that's not true, but that's the argument you would make. You've always stood in favor of individual liberties and privacy. And what a person's doing in their bedroom is none of the government's business. And if they're using a doll for sexual satisfaction, that is none of the government's business. And that's the argument you make. When you go down the path of bringing in data, you can't prove what you're trying to prove. But what you are doing is you're acknowledging that if it does save one, it's okay to do it. And you've lost a battle at that point, because when you put a legislator in the position of having to take a publicly recorded vote, with the chief argument being, if it saves one, it's worth it, and that's all they've got their hang their hat on, you've put them in a terrible position. They don't have anything to tell their constituents. On the other hand, if you say this is big government intrusion into the private lives of our sexual conduct, which you may be next, then you have something that lawmaker can hang their hat on and say, I voted against it because this is something that this is a dangerous path to go down. Data is not your best friend. Again, the National Rifle Association never uses data. Why is that, Andy?
I believe the answer is because they make it very challenging to collect any data. Therefore, there is no data. But if there were data, then it would be obvious that the ownership of guns is what causes all the deaths in the United States.
Well, we've got the data, though. We can show clearly that the Las Vegas shooter, we have enough data to know that the number of hits that he was able to achieve would not have been achievable if he had been using an old-fashioned revolver. We've got that data already.
Sure. Sure.
But he was using something I don't understand to accelerate his ability to fire. I don't understand all these terminology, all these things related to guns.
Oh, please, Larry, let me explain it to you. Pretty please let me explain it to you. Because this thing, this thing is so ridiculous. It's called a bump stock. And so you shake the gun back and forth to make it recoil and reload the next round. But if you're shaking the weapon, violently shaking it, the only thing that it would do is spray them in the most non-accurate method possible. If the intent of having a weapon like that is to aim and shoot with accuracy, then a bump stock would do the exact opposite, because you're violently shaking the thing to reload the next round. So the only purpose for that thing is to put as many rounds down there as you possibly can come up with, without any care for the accuracy of it.
Well, that is correct.
It's ludicrous.
but that's my point. The NRA will not have a discussion about data. For all you data-sensitive people that want to go there, they won't. They'll point to one thing, the Constitution. We need to start learning from them. I mean, they've perfected this argument. They point only to the Constitution, and they say, gee, there's no limit on gun ownership, which even Scalia, the late Justice Scalia, says that's not true. But they don't ever interject data into their discussions. If they do, they'll say something to the effect that the person was legally authorized to own the weapon. Well, of course they were legally authorized to own the weapon, because we don't have any laws, with very few exceptions, other than felons and those convicted of domestic violence, of owning weapons. And then there's age limits. But other than that, practically everyone can own a weapon. So of course this wouldn't have stopped it, because they were legal under the current laws.
So what you're ultimately saying is that you should double down on the Constitution, as this is big government intrusion. Get out of my bedroom. Consenting adults doing whatever they want to do, kind of thing.
Well, that's what, if I were stuck in Arizona and I had to come up with a strategy, like I say, the margins were not large margins. I was thinking Arizona had a larger margin of Republican control, but they barely, it's like a 2-seat majority in each chamber. But I
Okay.
would go to the people who run the legislature right now, even though it's a slim majority, they're controlling the calendar, they're controlling everything. And I would appeal to what they claim that they're for, which is very limited intrusion into people's private lives. And then, as a compromise, I would say, now, in terms of people who have been convicted of sexual related offenses, of course we can have these type of restrictions because they're still paying their debt to society during the period of time they're under correctional control. Those type of dolls could be, of course, prohibited. That would be a violation of your probation. Now, I don't necessarily agree with it, but that would be a constitutional thing you could do, even though I would not be in favor of it. But that's, in politics, you have to sometimes agree to things that you really aren't in favor of as a part of a compromise. So you would give them a victory, saying, we will make sure that anybody who's been convicted of a sexual offense while they're under supervision can't be doing this. And they get to go out and claim victory. And you get to go out and claim victory to the extent you want to because you killed the piece of legislation. At least you watered it down to a point that you can live with it.
Alrighty then. So let's move along then. We will move along to some legislative update stuff that you have for New Mexico. And what happened today, give or take, like in the last handful of hours? As I understand it, House Bill 233 was on final passage in the Senate, and on the floor amendment was offered. What is the significance of the floor amendment in the final hour? What is House Bill 233 anyway?
Well, it was dealing with our Department of Regulation and Licensing. And now listen to what you said. You said House Bill 233, and it was on final passage in the Senate. So
Yeah, sure,
therefore,
right.
you have a House bill that's on final passage in the Senate. If something gets changed in the chamber it didn't originate, it has to go back to the originating chamber for concurrence. And it's potentially a death sentence because when you only have an hour left in the session, the House is jamming down trying to pass as many pieces of legislation as they can. And they're also waiting for messages from the Senate on things that may have fallen into this situation that need concurrence so they can take a concurrence vote. But this is risky business when you put a floor amendment on in the final hour. And so that's what I was trying to explain to people, that anything that's amended in the final hour that has to go back to the previous chamber where it originated for concurrence, that is very risky.
Can you remind me what concurrence is? I've heard that in other contexts before. I mean, I'm not other contexts. I've heard it, related to like the US House and Senate. What does concurrence mean?
Well, since each chamber has, in a bicameral, each chamber has to pass an identical piece of legislation, if it's amended in the Senate, it's not identical at that point, is it?
No, that sounds about right. It's not identical anymore.
Okay, so then you would send it back over to the House where it originated and ask them would they like to concur with the Senate change. And
Okay.
if they say no, we do not like that amendment, we will not concur, then the message would go back to the Senate that the House refused to concur and they asked the Senate to recede on the amendment. The Senate could say,
Okay.
thank you, but no thanks, we choose not to recede. The amendment stands. And then at that point, you need to appoint a committee of conferees from each chamber. So you'd appoint probably three or four conferees from each chamber, and they would hammer out an agreement. And it may be that the conferees would agree to accept the amendment, or they may agree to some changes. But once the conferees come back with their report, now remember, there's only an hour left. That
Right, I
process
gotcha.
is not likely to be able to unfold in the final hour. But when you're not in the final hour, that would be the process. The conferees would come back with a report and say, this is what we've agreed to. At that point, you only get to vote to accept the report or reject it. You can talk about it till you're blue in the face. You can talk about it for whatever the debate limits are, but the only vote you get to take is to accept the conferees report or reject it. So when people get all up in arms and they say, oh, well, they just took a voice vote, that's all you really need to do. because your only decision is whether to accept what the conferees worked out between the two houses or to reject it. So there's no need to do anything else.
Can you explain something else? So, like, so this is a full Senate vote, and this is 50 people?
42.
And so they're on the floor. Someone's, like, penciling in felony jaywalking, and then that piece of paper, like, a page runs it. Some 16-year-old person runs down the hallway to the House side and asks them, hey, like, excuse me, can you guys approve this thing? Is that how it, like, functionally works?
That's a little bit of a dumbed-down version, but that's essentially how it works. So the sponsor of the Senate amendment was wanting to... Now, it came from the Republican side of the amendment. Magically, the Republicans, the small government people, wanted to elevate... I'm just trying to let people understand, when you hear small government, don't always believe it. I'm really trying to educate here. So the small government people who believe in keeping government small wanted to create a new cabinet-level position for the Department of Regulation and Licensing. So the amendment was, rather than it being as it currently exists, having a superintendent of insurance, which is a department of government, they wanted it to be a full cabinet-level position, which means that the Senate would get to vote to concur, to approve, not to concur, but to approve the secretary of the Department of Licensing, Regulation and Licensing. So we had an amendment that was offered by the small government people to create a new cabinet-level position, and the sponsors were really hesitant, and they opposed the amendment. They considered it an unfriendly amendment, but the votes were not there. The votes were there to add the amendment. So once the amendment was added, then they voted to pass the bill because they were still going to go forward with it, so they voted to pass the bill. But at that point, the House's bill that started in the House as it came over to the Senate was not the same. So a message literally would have gone across, and I'm not sophisticated enough to know if they use electronic means these days, but in the early days when I started legislating, that's exactly what they would do. They would run that amendment over to the House, the other side of the rotunda. They would hand it to the clerk of the House. The clerk would turn around and start whispering to the speaker, we've got House Bill 233 as amended by the Senate. They're asking for concurrence. And the House Speaker would call it up and say, here's the amendment. And does the House consider this something that we want to accept? And they would vote to accept the amendment or to reject it. So that is literally how it works.
All right. And tell me what your thoughts are on this final floor amendment.
Well, I don't know if it was sinister or not. It could have been an attempt to kill the bill, or it could have been an attempt to gain more control over the Department of Regulation and Licensing on behalf of the Senate. I have never been able to read the minds of the people why they sponsored the amendment, but they did do something that could have easily killed the bill. Now, there was enough time, and it did get through the concurrence process. The House accepted the bill as amended, so it is now on its way to the governor, but it could have wrecked the bill.
I see. Okay. Can we move on to that? You have, there's a 60-day legislative session which adjourned at noon today. What do you have to say about the session in total, I guess?
Well, Liberty and Justice Coalition, LJC allies, and we worked on a number of proposals, and we're pleased to report that only one bill we opposed will be sent to the governor. And that bill is Senate Bill number 215, which creates the new crime of bestiality. It did pass in the final days, but we were successful in removing the provision that would have required anyone convicted to have to register as a PFR.
Oh, interesting. You did not support the bill, I imagine?
We did not support the bill. Our reluctance to support the bill was not because we in any way approve of such activity, but because the bill is redundant with existing statutes against animal cruelty. During committee hearings, proponents of the bill spoke of a correlation between bestiality and crimes such as child sexual abuse and child pornography, but no factual data was presented to support their assertions. And I know how you are about data.
I mean, I'm trying to think of how they would come up with some correlation between those two. we talked a couple episodes about your wonderful chemical castration bill. What was the results of that?
We were successful with that. That was House Bill 128, the chemical castration bill. That bill, of course, made national news, and I think I had a reaction when you asked me, was it going to pass? We were successful in getting that bottled up in committee. In addition, we were successful in defeating House Bill 445, which would have expanded the list of offenses requiring PFR registration, and it would have broadened the definition of human trafficking to include practically everything that you could think of sexually is would have been human trafficking. So we were able to do that.
That all sounds really fantastic that y'all were able to pretty much squash everything. And at least from a PFR point of view, if the other thing is still criminal, but at least you don't end up on the registry for it. So that all comes from having the LJC doing that work. What else, what other kind of stuff were you facing beyond that?
Well, we certainly didn't do this alone. We worked with our allies, but the most difficult challenges we faced were bills that would have extended the civil and criminal statute of limitations for those accused of sexual misconduct. And so we dealt with Senate Bill 82, which I think was the one on civil statute of limitations, and Senate Bill 126, which were what dealt with the criminal statute of limitations. And we were able to bottle those up in committee. But a version of both of those have been around for a long time, and they will keep coming back again and again and again in 2024 and thereafter, because this is a national movement. Remember the talking point, justice should not have an expiration date. And that is what's been happening across the country. We've been fortunate to keep them from making any radical changes here, but our luck may run out, and it's not really luck. It's really hard work, relationships, and compelling arguments about, yes, justice does have an expiration date because the evidence gets lost, memories fail, people die. That would be crucial to the other side, to the accused. You know, the accused is the person whose rights we have to protect more because they're going to the cage. And I don't have any hesitation to say that. I feel bad for anyone who's victimized. But I also recognize the imbalance of the power of the state and the government versus an individual. And the person who is going to be put in the cage, their rights have to take priority in terms of them being protected, because you may be devastated if something did happen to you years and years ago. But we have to give that person we're going to cage, put in a cage, a fair, robust process before we put them in that cage.
I understand. Well, a good job there for New Mexico and LJC. That's really awesome that you all are able to do that with the amount of, I don't know, expertise and what's the word? I've just experienced that you guys have doing that. It would be great if more states could do it that way.
Well, I understand
wink,
that
wink,
they
nod,
do.
Nod.
I understand they do. Doesn't Florida kill everything that comes out down there?
I don't know. I don't hear any sort of updates from pretty much anywhere else other than Georgia and whoever else decides to, that I am on a newsletter from.
Well, doesn't
Georgia? I think West Virginia had halfway decent results.
Doesn't Georgia kill everything that comes before them?
Certainly not.
So, oh.
But not much has come up there lately either. I think there was only one or two bills that were going through Georgia that needed to be dealt with anyway.
Well, there were a number of bills that we were less impactful on that were killed by the coalition of allies. The statute of limitations, we all worked on that, but then there are things dealing with three strikes where we were against it, but we didn't spend a lot of time on three strikes. They want to expand our three strikes law. Remember, not a soul's ever been sentenced under our three strikes law that's been on the books since Gary Johnson was governor back in the 90s. Not a soul has ever fit within the narrow parameters of our three strikes law. And we've been able to achieve a success rate. In fact, the governor has even hinted around there may be a special session because not enough things to hammer down were passed this session. So she could very well call them back.
Larry, a question in chat real quick that seems relevant is about the statute of limitation stuff. And if the crime was before the invention of the registry, before the 90s, would they have to register?
They would have to register as long as there had not been an adverse decision regarding the registry that they couldn't, because as long as it's a civil regulatory scheme, you can apply a civil regulatory.
There's a friend of mine in Florida whose crime was before whatever registry stuff existed in Florida at the time, and they sucked him in.
Absolutely.
And he's on the registry now for life.
Absolutely. As long as there has not been a finding that there's an ex post facto violation, as long as it's civil, non-punitive, you got to build the framework to show that the registry is imposing punishment. You can't just go in and assert it because it's presumed constitutional. You know what you're going through, but you haven't proven it to the satisfaction of the courts.
And if, you know, using Florida as the model for compared to just about every other state, like, I mean, you know, you could probably compare it to Alabama as being toughest, but it's obvious and blatant that it's punishment if you're on the registry in Florida. If your crime was, you know, 50 years ago and now you're on the registry today, so you don't have anything that they've made it more bad since then. If you're just on whatever the minimum version of it is in Florida, it's still horrid. Listen back to two or three episodes ago of a guy writing in about riding motorcycles in a park. And is that an activity that he should refrain from doing? And you said, you think he should. Well, you think he should refrain from doing it because that falls in the crosshairs of it. And well, this guy got sentenced in the 90s.
Yeah, but that was because of locally imposed restrictions. But we have a loyal supporter in Florida who says the registry is not that bad. That, you know, he lives there and he says that, you know, it's just people, what they make of it. So there's differing opinions about how bad Florida is, but I can tell you Alabama's really bad.
No doubt. Okay, well, are we ready to move on, sir?
I hope so.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right. Uh-oh. Hey, man, you know what that sound is, right?
That sounds like breaking news.
So breaking news out of Rhode Island. I have found some articles and study, and I was studying for tonight's episode, Larry, but no, you decided to switch things around on me. Right at the last minute, you want to talk about a case from Rhode Island that's been going on for years. And literally, Larry, some of the first calls that I was on listening to, like the Narsal in Action stuff, was about Rhode Island. So what's the urgency that we must cover this without a doubt, like tonight? Scrap the whole schedule. Here we are.
Because the federal judge has rendered a decision.
Oh, well, that's easy. Do you want to just give me the bottom line up front and then we'll just go home? Just kidding. Just kidding. So I have looked through all of our stuff to see what we may have covered in the past. And our records show that RSOL, now known as NARSOL, provided funding to the ACLU of Rhode Island. And it was the ACLU that fought. Wait, don't we hate the ACLU, Larry?
Yes, we do. They're destroying this country. Correct.
I see. Okay. So it was the ACLU that filed the lawsuit back in 2015 challenging a recently enacted residency prohibition. What was so unique about the residency restrictions that NARSOL was interested in providing funding for this cause?
You're correct. Now, did you find this in our vast FYP archives?
I don't think we've ever talked about Rhode Island.
Well, you went to somebody's archives and found this stuff.
I found the NARSOL in Action call, I'm sure.
So, but you're correct. The residence restrictions are not that uncommon. But this particular prohibition is because it would have applied both retroactively and prospectively. That means registrants in Rhode Island would have been forced from their existing homes at the time this was passed. In fact, notifications had been given to people that had to vacate.
Now, legit, Larry, I don't live in Rhode Island. Why do I give two flips about people in Rhode Island if this doesn't apply to me?
Well, the answer is that if they can get away with retroactively forcing people from their homes in Rhode Island, it has the potential and certainly can spread to other states, possibly even yours. So that's the reason NARSOL decided to make the case a priority. NARSOL took our appeal of this critical case directly to our members and supporters in December 2015.
And how did that particular action go?
It did fairly well. Remember, this is 7+ years ago, but we raised over $14,000 that was turned over to the ACLU to help them cover case-related costs.
And that money covered the ACLU attorneys in full?
No, the money was not even to pay for their attorneys. It was to cover direct case costs such as expert witnesses and court reporters' fees for depositions and stuff. So it was to augment their small chapter of the ACLU's funding so that they would not be forced to forego. Remember what happened in Colorado when Alison Ruttenberg didn't have any money to do anything with?
I do.
Yeah, well,
yeah, it eventually backfired and they overturned stuff because she didn't use any expert testimony.
So, well, we were trying to avoid. Of course, that case had not been decided in 2015, but some of us understand that cases cost money to develop. So that was our model, was to try to make sure that they did not lack the funding they needed.
As with most of this stuff, Larry, like, these things change, and like, if you're just living your life, you don't know that a law has changed about a thing unless you're going down the road and they've changed all the speed limit signs, and well, now you're pretty much aware of it. So I'm assuming that the PFRs up there, they had no idea they were in danger of eviction until the law passed and they were notified that they had to leave?
That is correct. At the time the law was passed, I'm recollecting NARSL didn't even have any members in the entire state, and had there been a viable state organization there, it is possible that the outcome could have been different. Now, the ACLU did oppose the law, so I'm not saying it would have been different, but it's possible. But we didn't really have much going on in Rhode Island at the time, because Rhode Island wasn't that bad overall.
Right. And as I recall, Larry, this was a restriction that was going to change tier three people, kind of like the SVP level kind of people, and they were going to have like a 300-foot residency restriction kind of measurement. Yeah, if that's what I remember.
It was tier three, and that's a really misleading statement, because they have a risk-based system. So it was a level three as determined by risk, and they were going to expand the diameter from 300 feet to 1,000 feet.
Oh, okay. And God, there's only 45 people that live in Rhode Island, so this only would impact like 7 people.
Right.
And so the point, though, is that if there aren't affiliates, if the affiliates can't do work without the active participation and financial support. So NARSL works in collaboration with other organizations that do this amazing work for those convicted of PFR-type offenses, and those groups need our support as well. Do you mind if we then move on to what was actually in the decision?
Sure. The original version of the statute prohibited persons classified as level three within 300 feet of a school, and they increased it in 2015. The General Assembly amended that section of the law to increase this prohibition to residing within 1,000 feet of a school. So that was the essence of the case.
And I see that. I'll just read a bit from the court's opinion. The named plaintiffs brought this action claiming that residency restrictions is unconstitutional because, one, it violates due process rights under the 5th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution because it is vague, and that's count one. Number two is it violates their substantive due process rights because it infringes on their fundamental right to family privacy, and that's on count two. Number three is violates their procedural due process rights because it denies them liberty and property interests without due process of law, and that's count three. Number four is violates their constitutional right against ex post facto laws, and I recall that a temporary restraining order was ordered.
You are correct. Why the hell did you invite me here?
I just do it just to make me feel good.
So almost immediately after filing the complaint, the plaintiffs quickly moved for a temporary restraining order, which the court granted. In addition, the court then granted class certification to the plaintiffs, and the temporary restraining order was then converted to a preliminary injunction that has remained in effect throughout the pendency of this action, which is one of the reasons why I wasn't too worried about it. I mean, we're in the strongest position possible. If the state can't enforce the law, I don't care if you wait 20, 30, 40, 50 years to bring it to trial. I mean, you can take your time. We've effectively won. We just don't get our money. But I never did sweat this thing, because the preliminary injunction was take all the time you need.
And remind me, I believe that we learned this from the Georgia case, a preliminary injunction is pretty high achievement.
Well, even the temporary restraining order is. So the temporary restraining order is generally done with just one hearing from one side, and that's a very brief order that's issued. And then they have, like, the hearing that you attended down in Macon, Georgia. They have that, yep. And that's where you get the preliminary injunction, which is going to remain in effect during the pendency of the action unless it's overturned by the appellate court if the state were to appeal the injunction. I think in Georgia, the county agreed to the injunction. But it's a very difficult thing because you're getting relief you have not won.
Sure.
That's what people don't understand when they talk about go get an injunction. Wouldn't it be great if you could get your case decided before you've put on any evidence? I mean, it's great if you're the one who's launching the complaint and you want a decision on relief that you haven't won. But if you're on the other side of that, if your neighbor claims part of your land and you say, well, judge, go ahead and give him the relief even before you litigate and hear my defense, that's just not a good thing. So therefore, it has to be a very high standard. You have to show that you're likely to win when the case goes to trial. And that's the most important thing. But you have to show that you'll suffer irreparable harm. And nobody understands those two are very difficult. The irreparable harm was not hard to show in this case. If you get kicked out of your home, if you've been at 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years, it's fairly easy that you can show that harm from that could be irreparable. Say you had a house that you paid $20,000 for in 1979, and you're no longer allowed to live in it, and you have to go pay $672,000 today. If you can find anything, it's not hard to see that. But you also have to show, before you get to that point, you have to show that you're likely to prevail based on existing case law when the case does go to trial. And that's the problem so many people have to understand. You can't meet the tough standards of an injunction because you're getting relief you have not won yet.
I'm seeing that in 2020, the General Assembly further amended the statute to add language that clarified how the distance between a residence and a school would be calculated and limited the definition of schools to kindergarten through grade 12. Was that an attempt to extinguish the lawsuit, do you think?
It probably was. So,
to move on, then on page 2, it states, under the most recent scheduling order, to efficiently litigate this case, limited discovery proceeded first on the vagueness issue. With that discovery now complete, both parties move for summary judgment. Your favorite. Bing, bing, bing. I know you're not a big fan of that. So can you admit that this was a good strategy, being that our side won?
No, I cannot. You've just read a litany of counts above that the court above that have not been developed yet, which does not necessarily bode well for this case longer term. Remember all those? You remember count 1, count 2, count 3, count 4?
I do.
All right. Well, those weren't developed.
I'm just thinking that pretty much you're hopeless.
Well, I guess I am.
Anyway, plaintiffs contended that the residency restriction is void for vagueness, both as applied to them and facially. In its cross motion for summary judgment, the state first argued that plaintiffs are not properly situated to mount an as-applied challenge because none of them is affected by the alleged ambiguities. Now, that's funny. Were they arguing that the plaintiffs, by virtue of their preliminary injunction, could not bring an as-applied challenge?
It does seem like that's what they might have been arguing. I didn't really have enough time to do thorough prep, but it seems like that might have been what they were arguing here. But it certainly appears so. Then the state argued that even if the plaintiffs can mount an as-applied challenge, they have failed to demonstrate that the residence restriction is vague as applied to them. The state further argue that plaintiffs have failed to meet the much heavier burden of showing that the statute is facially vague, which is a very tough one. That means that there's no set of circumstances which you can do something. And that's why I tell people, please listen to this. The reason why you can't strike down the registry by a court action when you say the registry in its totality, there is a scenario where you could constitutionally register people. So that means a facial challenge, getting this lovely court order that says you can never register people. That's why that order will never, ever come, because there are registries that would be constitutional. So that's what that means here, that the much heavier burden of showing that it's facially vague is a tougher one than as applied to the individual.
Can you remind me what void for vagueness, what does that mean?
Well, it's one of my favorite things to talk about for a statute to comport with the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment due process. It must, one, define the criminal offense with sufficient precision that a person of ordinary intelligence can't understand what conduct is prohibited. And two, it must define the criminal offense in a manner that does not encourage arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. Due process requires both fair notice to its citizenry and standards for enforcement by the police, judges, and juries. In other words, an ordinary person is not afforded due process of law if he or she cannot read a statute and figure out what and how they can conform their conduct to the requirements of law. You got to be able to understand it. It cannot be vague.
And if we looked at how they were going to do the measurement, did they just say from such and such address to such and such address? Whereas like in a state like Georgia, they, at least my understanding is that like the interpretation is from the closest corner of the property, not where the residence is or the building is, but from the corner of the property to the corner of the property. Is that where it crosses the line from being vague to something? What's the opposite? Specific? What's the opposite legal term for vague?
That is an example. Now, that wasn't the case here. The legislature did clean up how the measuring was done. But yes, that would be a good example when you don't do, a person doesn't know necessarily if they're within 1,000 feet, if they don't know how the 1,000 feet is being measured. Is it being measured from the outer property line? Is it being measured from the last building that's being used? Is it measured from the property line if they've got 40 acres that's never used? Or is it measured from? So it goes into great, you need to get into great specificity so a person can look at that and say, I'm not allowed to live there.
I see. I believe then on page 11, the judge stated, the court finds that the statutory text itself is puzzling. The statute defines a school as the buildings and real property of kindergarten, elementary, middle, and secondary institutions, whether public or private. The residency restriction compounds the ambiguities by using circular language. The residency restriction specifically requires that a person subject to it cannot live within 1,000 feet of real property that supports or upon which there exists a school. Larry, legal language like that is ridiculous. It goes on and says, but a school is the building and real property of the kindergarten, elementary, middle, and secondary institutions. Are the two the same or are they materially different?
Well, don't ask me, but that's what the judge was struggling with. The judge stated, because the statute has not provided any further detail into what constitutes a school, the court must start with the ordinary definition of the word in considering these examples. When interpreting a statute, the court's ultimate goal is to give effect to the General Assembly's intent. The best evidence of such intent can be found in the plain language used in the statute. Remember, it's all about the text.
Are you being a textualist again?
Sometimes it suits my purposes.
The judge stated, as a starting point, one might plausibly define a school as the buildings and real property that the school owns or leases. But why does the statute not come out and explicitly say that or make some other clearer articulation?
Again, I don't know, but the judge speculated. The judge said one answer is perhaps there are other spaces that a school uses, but neither owns nor leases, that the General Assembly intended to include in the definition of a school. And considering the opposite, what about a building or real property that the school leases irregularly, e.g. like once a year for graduation?
So like the New Orleans Superdome has high school graduations in it. Does that count? Now you can't live within 1,000 feet of the New Orleans Superdome?
That would be funny, wouldn't it?
That would also be would be what I would classify as ludicrous. I was just speaking in chat that a school near me, they rent like an abandoned strip mall as an annex. So that now qualifies as the school property?
Maybe it does.
All right. Well, given this linguistic jumble, if one is prosecuted for violating the residency restriction, because he or she could not parse the ambiguous scope of a statute, or more troubling, could not foresee the state's construction of an ambiguous statute, that is the exact infirmity that constitutional due process prohibits, citing United States versus Williams 553 U.S. 253,304 from 2008.
So that is one of my favorite cases. Williams is, I go for my explanation for, that's the case I go to for my explanation for void for vagueness. The Williams court held a conviction fails to comport with due process if the statute under which it is obtained fails to provide a person of ordinary intelligence fair notice of what is prohibited or is so standardless it authorizes or encourages seriously discriminatory enforcement. You've heard me say that many times, some variation of that. And I get it from United States versus Williams because I read that case. It's very significant in terms of when you want to argue about whether something is void for vagueness.
Do you think you could do like a 10-minute deep dive into that case on one of our episodes?
We sure could.
That'd be cool. To move along, on page 18, the judge noted that the state tried to articulate such a standard. The judge said, to begin, the court cannot ignore the fact that the state itself has had trouble in defining these terms. In fact, it has defined relevant terms at least three ways during the litigation. Now, okay, I'll admit, Larry, that that one's funny.
So you finally can see the humor in some of this. The judge said, no matter what caused the shifting definitions in discovery, plaintiff's confusion on the state's position is understandable. The greater point, however, seems to be that if the state has had difficulties in properly working out these definitions, then those difficulties themselves support the idea that the statute is unconstitutionally vague. Duh!
Clearly, the judge gets it here. He stated such difficulties would prove far greater to an ordinary person. After all, if the state's process involved law enforcement, school officials, and attorneys collaborating to make precise, individualized determination on these boundaries, how could an ordinary person be expected to faithfully follow this process, let alone come to the same conclusion about where these boundaries lie? Was the court unable to locate a single case on point in terms of school boundaries?
Great question. It seems like they did have some difficulty, but this is an opportunity to talk about persuasive authority. Because you've heard me use that term a lot over the last 5 years, right?
Yes.
Okay, on page 20, the court referred to Doe's versus Cooper from North Carolina. The judge stated, while that case is not binding on the court, its logic is quite persuasive. Now, that's what we mean by persuasive authority. The Rhode Island residency restrictions does not specify how often students must use real property before it constitutes a school, nor does it provide any examples to help in this determination. So when you hear me talk about persuasive authority, even though it's not binding, courts can look at that and say, wow, that was well thought out. I'm going to apply that here. So the judge chose to incorporate Doe versus Cooper, even though it has no power in controlling his decision.
And then the judge stated, and the state does not even provide examples beyond its discovery responses. Further, because the state's examples do not appear in any public forum the way a statute would, or the way authorized agencies sometimes provide guidance on their websites, they become both legally and practically less relevant. All right, we need to move along pretty soon. Do you have any other points that you want to go over?
I do. The stated oral argument raised that a person who is prosecuted for violating residence restrictions despite residing in a zone of ambiguity would be protected by the lack of scienter as a defense. The state contended that when it is ambiguous whether one is subject to residence restrictions within 1,000 feet of a school boundary, the defendant could not be legally convicted because he or she lacked knowledge that he or she resided within 1,000 feet of a school boundary.
What did the court find in terms of that argument then?
The court was not amused. The court stated this approach presents compelling on its face because that's a legitimate defense, you know, but the resulting scheme proves unworkable. Under this theory, the state would first filter which persons as to whom it believed it could establish scienter in a prosecution for violating residence restrictions. The state would then try each person, and a jury or perhaps a judge in some cases would ultimately find the person knew or did not know that he or she was violating the residence restriction. Do you see the inconsistency that would happen there if they tried to use that?
I do. Can you explain scienter again? You have before, but I'm dumb.
Well, but plus we have tens of thousands of new listeners since then. That is the mental state of knowledge. So in most criminality, you have to know what you're required to do. So in this case, the person would say, I didn't know it was an exclusion zone. But you've effectively shifted the burden to them to prove something. And remember, they're presumed innocent. They're not supposed to have to prove anything. So therefore, the requisite burden is on the state to show that you did know that you weren't allowed to live there. And this was going to flip that on its head if the judge had bought into that argument that the state made. Well, they'd be protected by it. Well, no, they wouldn't have been. It would have led to all sorts of arbitrary and capricious enforcement and convictions. You got to have knowledge. It's scienter, S-C-I-E-N-T-E-R.
Yeah. Is that the same that we talked about in the May case of burden shifting? Is that the short definition, scienter, is burden shifting?
it can lead to burden shifting, but it's really knowledge. You have to know. We don't care on some regulatory things whether you know about it or not, because the penalties for violating, if you're speeding and you didn't see the sign and some kid took the sign down and you were going 50 and a 30, we don't care that you didn't know. It's not going to have any lifelong ramifications. You're going to get 3 points on your record and you're done. So we really don't care about scienter. But when we're going to saddle you with lifetime consequences to your reputation with most felony offenses, then there has to be knowledge. So I continue to maintain that the laws that, like in Michigan, that dealt with Zach Anderson, where that he was not able to say that he didn't know that the young woman was under the age of 16, I believe it was. I believe that's an unconstitutional statute because they said there's no such defense. I believe that every statute of a significant importance that carries felony consequences, there has to be proof that you knew that you were breaking the law. You just don't have that when someone comes into a bar and there's the presumption that they were over age, and then it turns out magically they weren't above the age. The state should have to prove that you knew that that person was underage. Now, if they can prove it, you still deserve to be convicted, because you're not absolved from having sex with a 16-year-old just because they're in a bar. If the 16-year-old, once you start making out, if the 16-year-old tells you, well, I hate to tell you now, this is a lot of fun, but I am a minor, you need to stop. Yeah, it's kind of like the entrapment. You need to stop when the teenager tells you that they're a teenager.
Right. I'm trying to remember the word Catherine Carpenter used when talking about these, particularly the ones involving minors, and I'm drawing a complete blank on what it is, where the consequences should be pretty low, where you don't have knowledge of it. Not scienter is not the word that I'm looking for. Can you fill in that gap quickly?
I remember that talk, but I don't remember the particulars of what she was arguing.
God, that word is hurting my brain. Okay. Well, the judge also then finally said, in just describing a simplified version of such a scheme, one can see that inconsistent enforcement would likely exist. Who has the knowledge that he or she is violating the residency restrictions would turn on individual decisions by various individual prosecutors, judges, and jurors.
Which is what makes the statute void for vagueness.
I gotcha. So what's next, Larry? Do you think that this case is dead and that they won't appeal?
I would be very surprised if they don't appeal.
All right. Mr. Doom and Gloom again. No, but I mean, so this is good news for our people. So were there people that got removed from their homes?
But for the injunction, they would have. They were serving notices on people at the time.
I recall that.
Yes. So now.
And And I recall there were situations where perhaps you're the owner of the house and they were like, well, I mean, you can't throw somebody out that owns it, but here I rent it. Sorry, you're on your ass.
Well, actually, we're going to throw out the owners too, because they'll tell them you can still own the house. You just can't reside in it.
God. I also don't understand. I mean, I understand. It just doesn't really make sense to me. Why are these people so willing to die on these hills with these cases, these laws? That are they don't pass like a sniff test. They're just popular by the population. Therefore, we should do them regardless of whether they're effective, whether they're constitutional, whether are we just mean bastards in the United States?
Some of it is systemic. We have systems that people don't understand that cause things to happen that people would rather not have happen. And it's in the private sector as well as the public sector. You're forced, like I've talked about, given a little bit of break for the news media. They're in a system that they don't have any control over as an individual organization. When you get hired to be a news director of KOB TV in Albuquerque, your job is to get KOB ratings as high as you possibly can. Your job is not to do morally good at the expense of making a profit. That's what the corporation exists for, is to make a profit for its shareholders, right?
I believe so.
So well, the Attorney General of Rhode Island is in a difficult position. He or she, I don't know what the gender is, but he or she is in a difficult position now. They've got a statute that's been declared unconstitutional that clearly is of desire to the people of Rhode Island because they've expressed that desire through their elected officials that they want this. And
right.
They expressed it. They expressed it in 2015. They expressed it again in 2020 when they amended it for clarity, knowing that the lawsuit was pending. So that that elected person is in a system where if they decide, well, I'm just going to throw up my hands and not defend this law anymore, they have the prerogative of doing that. But do you remember what happens when you do that? Remember when the Obama administration chose not to defend the what was called the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, that proclaimed that marriage was between a man and a woman? Do you remember the ridicule that they got for not defending DOMA? So you've got an attorney general that has the potential to lose the office of the attorney general over something that the people want. And they face vilification from the other side, potentially. So therefore, the desire is going to be to defend the law. And that's why I think the odds are greater that there will be an appeal. I can't guarantee it because I don't have a direct pipeline to that office. But depending on the political dynamics, which I don't know that's going on in Rhode Island, who's to say that the election is not in 2024? And who's to say that there's not someone chomping at the bit to want to be an attorney general of Rhode Island that's going to make this a huge issue? So if the attorney general that's sitting now is running for re-election, he or she is not in a position to say, well, I'm not going to fight this thing no more. They're just not in that position.
Probably don't say it like that, though.
They're just not in a position to do that. Systemically, they're caught in a situation where they are forced to do things that are less desirable. We had that speech at the conference in Cleveland where the attorney general came in and said, I wish I hadn't done that. Remember?
I do, vaguely, yes.
So you, when you give people grief about things, they're in systems they can't control.
Right. Okay. Hey, we are short on time, but I do want to cover this article that you threw in there just because this is insane. Because this is from News Nation. Never heard of it. Minnesota father kills PFR with moose antler. Never heard of that one before. That's why I wanted to put this in here. I'm sure I can come up with reasons why you put this in here, but why did you put this in here?
It's just a moment, really, to say how sad we are from something or something like this happening. I don't have enough information to really go into great detail about it. Minnesota has very few of their people publicly listed, as I understand, on the registry. He was in a very small town, and I don't even know if he was publicly listed. He certainly isn't now, but I don't know if he was at the time. But it could be that being in a small town, everybody knew. But apparently he was bothering this father in a way because he felt like that he was stalking children. And he was not able to do anything through the legal system to get relief from the irritation of the man. So he decided to provide himself the relief by killing him. And the antlers was the last thing. I think he beat him with a shovel, if I remember right, a dozen times or more with a shovel. And the antler was just the final thing. He might have been dead by then. But this was a really old man, like in his 70s. Not as old as
he
was. Very old.
It was a 27-year-old beat. Yeah, it was a 27-year-old beat the 77-year-old. That does, I don't want to go fight Arnold Schwarzenegger at this point because he's still a big dude, but generally, I'm thinking 77-year-olds are pretty frail. Generally.
Yes. And so it's just all a tragedy. Right. I have sympathy for the family of the human being that's life was taken. But having said that, this man deserves a fair trial. He deserves a robust defense. Sure. He deserves the presumption of innocence. And the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did this. Now, since he went in and confessed immediately, the state's case is going to be fairly strong. And a defense is going to be very difficult to mount. So this will probably result in a plea agreement of some type.
Right. All right. Okay, well, we will close out the show because we are just a hair past time. So find all of the show notes over at registrymatters.co. And, of course, support the program with all the people that came and joined in the program tonight over at patreon.com/registrymatters. For as little as $1 a month, you can become a patron, and we appreciate all of our patrons. And without anything else, Larry, if you have any parting words, it's great. Otherwise, I will talk to you very soon.
Well, you forgot to tell everyone to subscribe on YouTube and hit the like button and 5-star reviews because our audience is going up. We picked up some subscribers last week.
Fantastic. Yep. So feel free to press like and subscribe and do all the things with the notifications so that YouTube likes us better. Oh, have a great night, sir.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.